Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Conservationist Conversationist. We're talking about politics and the environment and some pop culture and too much Pokemon. I am Brandon, and your host.
And my co-host. I am Aiden Wood. Oh, yes, I am Aiden Wood, your other co-host.
Aiden, so you were traveling around California, right? You're up in the Bay Area this weekend?
Yeah, I was. I flew up north from Orange County to San Francisco to go to a wedding, my cousin's wedding. So we landed at San Francisco Airport, and then we drove up. So apparently people who are familiar with San Francisco would know this. The app told us it would take 3 hours-ish to get from San Francisco Airport to like Greenwood, like the Escondido coast, like that area. It took us 6 hours because apparently that's just what life is like in the Bay Area.
My dad was actually in San Francisco this weekend as well. So who knows, maybe you crossed paths with him.
Maybe.
But I'll have to ask him how traveling was. He just said, like, I tried to warn him of this. He was like, it's so cold here. I'm like, Dad, I told you that. He's like, yeah, but it's summer. It's not winter. I'm like, yeah, it's actually cooler in the summer, it feels like sometimes, because of the offshore breeze in San Francisco than it is in the winter even.
Yeah, it was super cold. And we went up north to like Escondido County. And it was, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. But we went up like on top of these bluffs, and like there was all these hills, and like it was like right on the coast, the Pacific coast, and like it was freezing. And I don't own any really warm jackets because I live in Orange County.
Right.
My mom has all of my warm coats back home in Michigan for when I fly home. Like, I never bothered to bring them on the plane, and I was just, like, regretting that so much.
Yeah, no, it's totally,
my pet rat has been climbing all over me lately, so you might hear me play with her, or she just tried to jump up from my leg onto my computer, and she fell down to the ground, and it was extremely cute.
So, yeah, what I was saying was the nice thing about the Bay Area, though, is that it is beautiful, and once you drive about 30 or 40 minutes inland, it gets really, really warm. Like Santa Rosa, Napa, all beautifully warm places.
Yeah, it was refreshing because like in Orange County, I've spoken about this before, it's like as someone from the Midwest, like it just gets depressing, like the constant sun and like warmth. I like cool, crisp air, you know, like I like refreshing. I like rain. I like the sound of rain and the way it makes the air smell. You know, I love that stuff. So, like, it was good to take a break from Orange County to visit up north. And it made me realize, like living in Orange County, like, when I go, like, months without visiting home in Michigan or going somewhere that's green, like, I start to feel like, I could make a life here, you know? Like, I could live here forever, like, get into the TV industry. Like, there's collaboration opportunities. There's, like, public transit, sort of.
See, it's too bad that I don't know if there's that many TV opportunities up here or whatever, but it sounds like your perfect place is like Oregon or Washington.
Probably, yeah. But like when I visit those places, like all of those thoughts that I have like disappear. I'm like, oh no, this is where I was supposed to be. I can convince myself that like Orange County is okay when I feel like I'm stuck there.
Yeah.
But like once I'm like in a place that's like green and like has water and nature and like animals, like when we were watching like the ravens and falcons swirling overhead, I could hear seals. We went glamping like in a yurt as part of the wedding,
right.
And so we went glamping, and I was like lying on a cot in my yurt, and I could like hear seals outside.
That's cool.
Like on the cliffs. Yeah, it was awesome. Like, yeah.
I've always wanted to stay in a yurt, by the way. I never have, and it looks so cool. I would love.
It's literally just a tent. It's just a tent that's like a particular shape of a tent. It's I don't know. Like I was expecting it to be like cool and like in like really interesting. It's just a tent.
Well, but I've seen though the yurts that people like. Well, so I guess there must be like different types, because like I've seen the ones that are like big and they have like a couple rooms even, and this one must
not,
be.
This is not this. This was me. Okay. It was like a, like maybe a like 10-foot diameter.
Me and my
two younger brothers, so three people, three twin size beds like in there. And then it was like, okay, so it was like a glamping experience,
right?
And it was like we walked in and it looked super fancy. Like they had like hot coffee, like hard coffee grounds in a French press and tea bags, and they had like the fancy like lights, but they didn't, and then like they had like instructions for like making the coffee, but it was like, don't put the French press on an open heater, instead like instead like heat water separately and then pour it in there, but they didn't give us any way to heat the water. Like there was no way to heat the water, and so like we were just
sticks together.
Coffee grounds that we couldn't use.
You gotta rub some sticks together outside, make a fire, put the water over the fire.
Yeah. No, but traditionally yurt is covered in skins or felt, so that's not vegan. So
no, it's not. But the modern day yurts are usually like, I usually like a canvas.
Yeah, it was a canvas.
Your friend, whoever the wedding was for, it sounds pretty awesome though, how they had it set up.
It was good. The bride walked down the aisle to Hedwig's theme from Harry Potter. So
that's really cool, actually.
Yeah, it was. There was like some like a woman playing like Scottish songs and a violin.
Oh wow.
It was fairly informal. But not like it wasn't informal, but like the dress code for the wedding was wear whatever you want to wear, as long as it's like a little like fancy or special. Mm. Like wear whatever you always wanted to wear, what you've always wanted to wear but have never had a reason to. And I always wanted to wear a cool denim jacket with patches on it, like iron-on patches. And so what I did is I got a vintage denim jacket from a local thrift shop, and I ironed on patches on the back that said "Congrats, Jimmy and Hannah" with like cool flowers. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was good. I got a lot of compliments. I got too many compliments, actually. I was like, I am an introvert. Like, I can't handle this.
Right? And I thought, yeah. No, but it is so funny because, like, that's, like, something that sometimes the older, not all older generations, by the way, but a lot of them will say, you know, like, with that sort of, like, thing. They'll be like, oh, what's this with the, you know, that sort of dress code. For me, like, that's why I love these generations. Like, that is the coolest way to have a dress code, right? Wear something you never, or you've always wanted to wear. That's awesome. That sounds.
Yeah. I was thinking a lot about the wedding I want to have someday. I don't know who it's going to be with or like when, but like, I'd like to have like an outdoor camping wedding, like almost like a separate camp vibe where like we would go hiking up to the grounds, and there would be like a big, like, kind of like when you go to summer camp, there's like a big mess hall for like a big, like, yeah. Yeah, but then like I want to have like the actual ceremony on at like a beach with a dock, and I want to like have get married like at the end of the dock, and then like after we say our vows and kiss to jump into the water, and then like the party starts, and like people can like jump into the water and like have a grill right there, so like to like start serving food like as soon as like the ceremony's over, and to just sort of like have a campfire going. I don't know. I think it'd be really fun.
That sounds like fun. If I'm invited, I can't wait.
So, yes, you are invited.
Well, I hope that so if anybody's listening and you're single, Aiden is a very, very eligible bachelorette. So
I am, however, at this point probably too tired
wait until she's not so tired, and yeah.
But Brandon, when you get married, you can steal the idea. So if you want to do that too, and then I'll just come visit yours, and that'll be less of a time commitment.
So if you don't mind, I'm going to springboard off of this a bit. I have a question for you regarding weddings. You mentioned grilling food. So here's my question, right? Because my friend who, I think we talked a little bit about it when I was just at his wedding about a month or so ago. And it was awesome. He had a pizza food truck come in, and they had vegan pizza. He wanted to make sure that for those of us who were vegan, we had something to eat, as well as the people who are lactose intolerant, you know, that sort of thing. So I thought that was phenomenal. I have heard, like, I remember my brother, who is not vegan, he kind of was a little bit annoyed that one wedding that he went to where they were both vegan, he was kind of annoyed that they were not going to have anything but vegan food. And I kind of feel like that, because I feel very strongly about my vegan diet, I feel like I would try to have stuff for everybody, but I feel like if it's very edible and, you know, like, comfort food, even if it's vegan, there's no reason for me to have non-vegan food, because everybody can eat vegan food, besides having, like, you know, some allergy want for people who have allergens, you know, gluten-free, et cetera, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
How do you feel? Do you feel like if you have a bunch of people who are coming, would you make sure that you were open because you wanted to be a fun day, happy day, no arguments, no hard feelings? Would you have both foods, or would you have completely vegan food?
I would. So for me, like veganism, or like just like not, I'm not eating animals. I should say vegetarianism, like, cause that's like more fundamental. Like, I've been vegetarian since I was a kid. Like, that's an innate part of like who I am, and like as soon as I knew what it meant to eat another animal, I didn't want to do it. And it feels very spiritual to me in a lot of ways. I wouldn't go to like a Jewish wedding and expect them to have pork if I wanted pork, right. You know, I wouldn't go to a Muslim wedding, like a traditional Muslim wedding and expect them to have beer, or a Hindu wedding and expect them to have cows. If a person's dietary restriction has like some like spiritual element, I feel like you can accept the fact that like you might want to grab a burger on your way there, you know? And yeah. Like I go to weddings and there was very little food there that I could eat. And the food that was there was, like, really bad. Like, and I, like people, like, throw a hissy fit about having vegan options or for vegans demanding vegan options. But, like, then they'll do the same thing. Like, when, like, if, like, people will, like, do the bare minimum, like, to have, like, a vegan option. I mean, I appreciate it. I appreciate, like, having that at all. Like, when they don't have to. But if, like, people are serving good food that you can eat, the fact that you're, like, throwing a hissy fit because it's just not your particular taste is annoying to me.
Yeah, I mean, so the way that I see is, like, for my friend, I thought for somebody who he's not vegan, for him to have good food there, good vegan food there in the sense of vegan pizza, which is a very good, easy way to go. And everybody was happy. Everybody loves pizza, right? And most everybody. He also had gluten-free crust as well for people who are gluten-free. So very well thought out. Total credit to Aaron and Jess, my friends. They were phenomenal with that. It got me thinking, well, you know, would I want to return the favor? But then again, it's not a restriction if you're not restricting what you eat, right? So whereas even though it might be a choice in our part and not an allergen or something like that, like you mentioned, it can be somewhat spiritual. And so I feel like that's why, as long as the vegan food is really good food, which let's be honest, you can get some excellent, you know, you can get meat alternative, meat substitutes. I mean, my gosh, you could have just meatballs there, you know, like vegan meatballs there, you know, for meatball sandwiches.
Beyond Meat Patty. Like,
right. Yeah, exactly. So I feel like for me, it'd be like, hey guys, we're going to have all the comfort foods. It's not going to be just quinoa bowls and that kind of shit. You know, it's going to be some, you know, I couldn't see myself. I make the exception to have some dairy or whatever, but it hurts me to think about that. I don't like buying stuff that is not vegan, you know, and sort of, I don't know.
My open house when I graduated high school, my mom like threw an open house and I wanted there to only be vegetarian food, to not have like animal products served there. But like my mom pushed me on it and eventually I was like, fine. Like she was the one planning it or whatever. And I regret that to this day. Like it basically like completely tainted the day, you know? I told my mom, like, you're trying to celebrate me and then you're doing something that's like complete. It feels like a fucking insult, you know, like it feels like a slap in the face. We're going to celebrate. Let's go. We're going to come here. And we're going to celebrate you by disrespecting like you and what you believe in. Like, I love you. Thank you. I mean, I do love you, Mom. I'm sorry about the sarcasm, but like, but she doesn't listen. This is okay.
Well, you know, now are you the only vegan in your family?
Yes, I am.
You are. Okay.
And I became vegan vegetarian when I was like 7 or 8-ish. And I became vegan a few years ago. And it was like hard, like being like a 7-year-old in a family of people who like totally ate meat. Like,
because I was 17.
Like, I do not want to do this.
Yeah, I was 17 when I decided to go vegetarian. And that was, my mom was very supportive. You know, and I don't think anybody was not supportive. They just were kind of like, you know, oh, Brandon's going through a phase. I'm not saying they said that, but that's the feeling I got, you know, right? And, you know, now here we are, 16 years later.
You look so proud. You, like, were grinning like, hey, fuck you guys. Like,
I mean, you know, and the funny thing is that I'm not even kidding you. Like, when I told I love my grandparents. They don't listen to this either. So, but, you know, when I told them that I was going vegan, I do think I saw their, like hearts drop. Because, like, my grandmother is from France, and she loves her cheese, and she loves her dairy. I think she just, like, you know, she would have the greatest pastries, you know, danishes and turnovers. And I've since opened them up to this world of the fact that you can have vegan pastries. I think that, like, I saw them both go, like, no, you're not serious about this, are you? And I'm like, yes, I am, actually. I'm definitely going.
Lo siento.
Yeah, lo siento. Anyways, so you know how we're going to celebrate today? We're going to celebrate because it is the second anniversary of the Conservationist Conversationalist. Woo! And we're celebrating by not talking about anything regarding politics, at least in the sense of the candidates for 2020. It's been 2 years of the Conservationist Conversationalist. You have been on for, gosh, how long has it been now for you?
I think last September.
Yeah, so you're like nearing, you're a few months away from being a year here on the podcast. Isn't that crazy?
That's fucking crazy. That is fucking crazy.
Yeah, but 2 years ago, I started this. To talk about, like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, talk about environment, politics, and pop culture. And here we are 2 years later, and I've got a wonderful wonderful co-host. And we're having a great time. So if we want to hop into the what's going on in the world of the environment though. Mm-hmm. Of course, everybody, if you listen to us, you know that we get a lot of our news articles from sierraclub.org. They have their In Case You Missed It section, which is we've said this a few times. Yes, we have some questions about the Sierra Club and their ties to the dairy industry and stuff like that. But away from that, this is a great place to get caught up on environmental news. And you know, nobody's perfect.
Yeah. And I'm probably going to like try and find other sources to like other sources that like aggregate environmental news into one place, right, that we're pulling from a few different sources. I think that'd be
absolutely
In Case You Missed It, it's literally just like a bunch of like one sentence summaries of like key events with links to articles where you can learn more.
Yeah, they do a great job. I mean, they really is well done by Sierra Club. They do a phenomenal job. So the first story that we're not going to, of course, talk about all of them, but the first story that stuck out, mainly because I cannot pronounce the name of the canyon in Iceland, but I love the Icelandic language. It's just crazy to look at and so cool, but I can't pronounce it. So Justin Bieber, who you know we were talking about before the show, you were wondering why people still listen to Justin Bieber.
Yeah, we were talking about it, and I don't hear a lot about like his new music. Like there was a time period when like there were certain Justin Bieber songs that were like pervasive, and I just don't fucking hear anything about him. I think that he's married.
He is married, yeah. What's her name? Baldwin. Haley Baldwin, I think is her name. Something like that. Baldwin. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just thought that like.
So I don't know. I'm trying to get the name of the video. I haven't seen the video, but he shot a new music video, and the canyon, whose name I can't pronounce, in Iceland. I guess a lot of his fans who are still crazy about him, they started to overrun the canyon, and so now the Icelandic authorities have closed the canyon because people got too cray cray. And but it brings up another story that's been happening this week, which is the fact that, you know, in this case, this is not necessarily motivated by money, but I'm a huge fan of climbing, and this story is still developing, so I won't, you know, get too much into the whys and the hows and what's going on, but you know, I followed people who climb Mount Everest and stuff like that since I was a little kid. And I've always been very, very fascinated with it. And this week, you know, we've seen pictures, and I don't know if this has been happening for the past 2 years, but this is the first time it's really been brought to the attention of the public through the media. And I think it's 11 climbers now who have died, I want to say. It could be more than that. And it's not because of the normal things that you've seen happen on Everest, whether it be storms or lack of oxygen. I mean, it is lack of oxygen, but for a different reason than altitude sickness. It's because it's so overcrowded at the top. I don't know if you've seen pictures, but it's insane that people are waiting in line to get to the top because there are so many people climbing Everest. And it's crazy what I think this day and age we live in, where more people feel empowered to do things that maybe they're not even ready for. In this case, maybe they are, but didn't, you know, but now you have them not capping the amount of people who are going in expeditions, where it used to be a thing where you would cap how many people could go. And it's kind of frustrating as a fan of climbing and a fan of this sort of thing to see that, and to hear that also there's been a lot of junk left behind. because of the amount of the sheer amount of people. And it's just, it's really, really sad for something that was taken very seriously, and people would go through years and years knowing they had to be on a waiting list to finally get to climb. And now to see them just load these expeditions with climbers, and it's now led to 11 deaths, and the weather was really good. So this was not something where it was caused by, you know, a freak weather incident or whatever. It's just people who, you know, imagine getting right there, what, a few steps from the top, and knowing you had to wait in line. I mean, a few steps, I'm obviously exaggerating. It's more than a few steps, but you get the picture. You can see the top from where you are.
Yeah. And it's wild. Like, I'm looking at the photos now. Like, it's like a long line of people on this, like, very treacherous, right, like attached to a safety hook, but like on this very treacherous, like, but it's like a long, long, long line of people. Like,
right. It's like, it reminded me, do you ever see those things where they show, like, this is what you think this area, this like vacation spot is going to look like, but when you get there and you see all the tourists, and that's what it reminded me of, one of those pictures, right? Where it's like, you don't, like, this is what Everest is really like when you're climbing, you know, at the top, and there's all these people waiting in line. And it hasn't always been that way. And it's really just kind of crazy to me. Because that's not the sort of thing that I, you know, grew up reading about and whatnot. And, you know, also another thing environmentally to bring up is that because there's been less snow this year, which I don't know if that has, but obviously you can make the argument climate change has something to do with that. They've actually been finding tons of human feces that were buried under the snow, and they've had to, Sherpas have had to barrel it down the mountain to get it cleared out. Dead bodies are being resurfacing because of the snowpack being low, and a lot of junk being left there. So it's a really crazy stuff. Really, really crazy how crowds can, the masses can ruin something, you know, and in this case, you know, like I said too, you know, now you've got people in their 80s who are climbing Everest, and that's great, but it's also now making everybody feel like they can do it. And obviously they're making it to this point, but the question was, you know, posed to me, well, once you get to that, you know, that part of Everest, let's just say you're climbing it, and once you get to that point, and you see that Everest is there, but you know that it's best, the peak is there, but you know it's best to get back down because you're going to run out of oxygen. Maybe. What do? You know, you've gotten all this far, and what do? And I can't imagine getting to that point and saying, I'm going to head home, you know, being on the top of the highest point in the world. And, you know, in a much, much lower scale, I remember climbing Mount Si in east of Seattle. And there's this thing called the haystack. Once you get to the top of Mount Sinai, it's this large rock, and it's about 250-foot drop if you fall. And I didn't have any ropes when I got there. And so I didn't want to not summit it. So I got to this point, and obviously, like I said, we're talking about a much lower thing here than Everest.
That's still potentially deadly, right?
Oh, yeah. Many people have died climbing the haystack.
Okay, cool.
So, good to know. So I thought, I'm not going to pass up this opportunity. I hiked all this way to get up to the top. I'm going to climb the haystack. And so I did, and I was fine. Obviously, I'm here. But so I couldn't imagine getting to that point on Everest and not summiting it, because my personality is, you're going to be fine. You're already here. You know, don't worry. I'm more the person who worries before the expedition. Once I'm there, I figure, nah, nothing can happen to me. But anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
So sorry for the long-winded thing, but yeah, it's just been a very crazy thing to witness for somebody who's a big fan of these things.
I'm reading an ABC News article now, or I'm skimming an ABC News article now, and I'm really struck by this quote. Doering, who scaled the mountain's popular south slope on Nepal's side with a small group of other climbers and a veteran Sherpa guide, said that he passed the bodies of several dead climbers. Among them was a woman who appeared to have just died and was still clipped to the safety line.
Jeez.
He also saw Sherpas dragging several people down the mountain who had collapsed from exhaustion, were sick, or injured. You can't do anything about a person who's dead, and it shook me inside, Doering told ABC News. It was unexpected. I mean, I know people die on Everest, but as you're moving along the safety line and it's dark and you're only seeing a few feet in front of you, and all of a sudden that circle of illumination has a dead body in it, it's very unnerving.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, and you hear these stories, and I've heard, you know, a few of my favorite climbers, Conrad Anker, and of course, John Krakauer, who wrote Into Thin Air. And I would love to hear what they have to say about it, because obviously, even though I followed this, I've never witnessed it firsthand. And so I would love to hear what they have to say, because to me, I mean, it has to be immediate that we start to bring in a cap to the amount of people who are allowed to go up Everest each year. Like, yeah. Crowds just can't happen, plain and simple. I would love to hear what they have to say. So hopefully that will become more of a thing as we move ahead. Cause I do value those guys and respect their opinions so much. They're incredible, incredible people, incredible climbers. But I guess so, moving on, I know this was really, really cool. You and I were talking about this. I saw in fact, I watched the whole video on it. It was really, really exciting. Researchers are raising Florida corals in tanks in hopes they can be used to breed new colonies after stony coral tissues, lost disease stops ravaging the state's reefs. It's really crazy because they figured this out on accident.
Yeah, can I talk about this?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. Take it away.
The technique is called microfragmenting. And it's essentially basically corals can take like 3 years or like they can take like years and years and years to grow to sexual maturity, which is what they need to be when they're planted, right? Or like when like to like thrive. Because corals, like a lot of people don't know this, but they're actually animals. They're not plants. They are like actual animals. They're just very different from any type of animal we know. but it takes them so long to reach sexual maturity. But what they've discovered they can do is they can cut a coral that is closer to sexual maturity, they can cut a coral that's like a few weeks old and take it and like separate the sections, and the coral will grow to the point that it was before. If you take a coral that's a particular size and you cut it into a lot of small like 1-inch pieces, it can grow to like that particular size in like a few weeks or a few months. And then so if you take these corals that are like have been cut and then have grown more rapidly to try and reach that previous size, and then plant them separately from each other, but in the same area, they can refuse together once they physically reach each other. And they recognize, these different parts of the coral recognize itself as the same animal, as like the same life form, which is crazy.
Yeah, so they communicate with each other.
They communicate with each other. They communicate. They're basically, it's basically like if you had, it's like, okay, you know, it takes like a human being, like, I think technically like 13 or 14 years to reach sexual maturity, like obviously emotional, like actual maturity and like actual adulthood is like a lot farther away. But like, imagine if you took like a person, like a human who's like maybe a 6-year-old, and you cut the 6-year-old into little pieces. you cut the 6-year-old to like little pieces. Like you took an arm and you took the arm over there, and then you took like a part of the leg and put the part of the leg over there. You took their nose and put it somewhere else. And then, like these different parts of the 6-year-old person like grew as like rapidly, like way, way, way more rapidly than like they would have grown like if they were still attached to the same person. And then, like once they had grown, you put them back together, and they recognize, these different body parts recognize each other as the same person again. And then, like they were an adult. And this happened in like a few weeks or a few months instead of taking 13, 14 years.
You just inspired one of the craziest horror movies that's ever going to get made, I think.
Oh my God. No. That's wild. Oh my God.
It's incredible. If you haven't watched it, go look it up online. It's crazy to watch how they do it. It's worth I think it's like a 10-minute video or something. It's not that long. It is totally worth it. The whole time I was watching it, just absolutely engrossed by it. It was so good. So check it out. It's phenomenal stuff they're doing in Florida. Not often do we get to say that. Phenomenal stuff they're doing in Florida. Usually it's crazy stuff that's happening in Florida.
I mean, it's kind of crazy in a different way. But
well, yeah, that's true. It is. But you know what? A good crazy.
Yeah, and again, that technique is called microfragmenting, or at least it is from my recollection. Let me just check that real quick.
That sounds right to me, but yeah.
Yeah.
While you're looking that up, there's not a lot to talk about this one, but this is pretty crazy when you think about how old the Earth is. Because we just, you know, and to think of how far we've come and what we've destroyed. The Canadian Arctic scientists discover fossilized fungi that are 1 billion years old. So it goes to show you, wait for it, that if you're just somebody who enjoys life and you're just an all-around fun guy,
no.
You're gonna live forever.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. Sure.
Did you see that one coming?
Yes, I did. I said it alongside you.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You did this right. You mentioned at the place you were at the wedding, there were ravens and falcons, which, by the way, I love falcons. I have a tattoo of a falcon on my right arm, and I love falcons.
Nice.
Ravens, though, hatch in the Tower of London for the first time in 30 years.
Yeah.
And
ravens are really cool.
They are.
I think they're cool. Corvids in general are just badass. I'll name my child Corvid.
You were talking about how much you love crows. You're a big fan of crows, and ravens are larger than crows. I remember going up to Mount Baker.
You know so much about these birds.
I know, but there's if you go up to Mount Baker, you don't realize how fucking huge ravens are until you see them firsthand. They are gigantic. Yeah, according to popular lore, the fates of both the Tower of London and the wider British kingdom are intrinsically linked with the presence of at least 6 ravens in the palatial 1,000-year-old fortress. As a royal decree reportedly issued by the 17th-century King Charles II warned, if the birds ever flee their London home, the tower itself will crumble to dust and a great harm will befall the kingdom. Now, luckily, there appears to be a little chance of this dystopian vision becoming reality anytime soon. The tower maintains a population of at least 7 ravens, and last week, officials announced the birth of 4 healthy chicks, the first hatch at the London stronghold since 89, when the tower welcomed a baby named Ronald Raven.
No, I mean, like, it's cute, like, because the raven and the baby were like, why would you, like, I like the pun. I didn't like the person the pun is based on. I'm emotionally conflicted right now.
Right? I mean, it's like.
Ronald Raven. Oh,
Ronald
my God.
Raven. It was 89, too, so it can't be a coincidence. By the way, that was courtesy of Smithsonian.com. And something, so I think we'll finish off this news with, though, we have a few things to talk about regarding this. So, you know, I've talked about it a few times on the show. I'm fascinated by lots of things, right? Climbing, birds, and whales, and Pokemon. Me and my mom will go to Kamano Island frequently to watch gray whales during this time. Gray whales come up here from usually around California, some from around Oregon, and most of them go to Alaska, but then some of them do go south back to Oregon as well. Mm-hmm. And this year's been one of those rough years because, much like the southern resident orcas, who I've been watching since I was 10, so in 1996, you know, and those populations have been dwindling. This year was kind of, although we did see several whales this year while we went on our adventures to Kamano Island, it's been a weird year because 58 gray whales have washed up dead along the Pacific coast this year, many of them having starved to death. And it brings up an interesting conversation because when you discuss the southern resident orcas, we know that they're starving as well, and they have a very unique a unique menu, basically, that they select from, and that's simply just Chinook salmon. And it works against them because our Chinook salmon runs are a lot smaller right now, and they don't have the amount of food that they need. For those of you who aren't as into cetaceans as I am, the transient orcas, or otherwise known as the Biggs orcas, they're the ones that you see eating mammals. So they will eat sea lions and seals and porpoise. They're a different type of whale. If you actually watch them, I can tell the difference just by seeing them surface because the fins are more sharp and shark-like, and they actually swim a lot different, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And where the southern resident whales, they're not like that. They have different behaviors. And this is coming from somebody who, for now over 20 years, has been, you know, studying these animals.
Yeah.
And then you have other whales, like a New Zealand population, who only eats one type of fish. Some of them only eat rays. Some of them in Norway only eat herring. So orcas are very unique in the way that yes, on the outside, they might sort of look similar. But the different sub-varieties of orca or subspecies are very, very different from each other. In fact, they just finally gotten pictures of a subarctic species of orca, subspecies, who spends way more time around the Arctic ice, and so they only have so much white around their eyes, and it's really fascinating, actually. If anybody wants to look that up, it's really fascinating to look at the different types of killer whales. But so we've seen that, you know, the transient whales, because they eat mammals, they've been doing very well, actually. There's a lot more transient whales in the population around here, and it's funny because they call them transients because they thought they were visitors here while the southern residents stayed here, and they started to find out that it's actually the transients, or big Zorka, who have actually been staying around here more, and it's the southern residents who go offshore and sometimes go down to Monterey, and anyways. But what we've seen are the transients are doing well, and even I've seen more harbor porpoise when I've been out kayaking, or when I'm out by the water, I see the harbor porpoise. They all seem to be doing well, but the southern residents keep dying off. And that has to do with food. So the interesting thing is, the gray whales mostly feed on ghost shrimp, and I don't know a lot about the ghost shrimp populations, but I was under the feeling that maybe they were all doing well because we've seen an influx in humpback whales here, and I realize they don't eat the same plankton or food as gray whales do. But we've seen more humpback whales here over the last few years, and it's been great for whale watching expeditions because the humpback whales disappeared years ago, and now we start to see them more. I saw my first humpback whale in the wild ever last year. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of shocking for me to hear that the gray whales are appearing to be emaciated once they're washed up on shore dead. And very sad, actually, because they've kind of become a big part of every year for me. I look forward to the spring and seeing the gray whales off Kamino Island or Whidbey Island, and or sometimes even off San Juan and Harrow Strait. And it's kind of sad what we're seeing. These are obviously animals that, if you can't tell, mean a lot to me. And so it's very, very sad to hear this. And and then today, sorry, again, I feel like I'm talking so much.
No, it's okay.
But again, today we actually just got word on that in Elliott Bay, which those of you who have been to the Seattle area, you'll know that's a very very iconic part of Seattle. It's where the Space Needle overlooks and the ferries cross Elliott Bay to get to Bainbridge Island or over to Bremerton on the peninsula. And a gray whale was struck by a ferry in Elliott Bay tonight. The ferry spokesperson said the whale breached about 5 feet in front of the MV Wenatchee during the 8:15 p.m. sailing from Seattle to Bainbridge Island. I just took that ferry actually a few weeks ago for a concert, and I love Bainbridge Island. I love that ferry ride. It's beautiful. The whale was struck about 3 minutes into the route, and the spokesperson said the captain was not immediately aware that the whale was struck. Some witnesses said they saw the whale bleeding. They don't know what the condition is at this time, but that's kind of an odd behavior, actually. In fact, you don't see gray whales breach a whole lot compared to other whales, and so you wonder what happened there, if it was just a coincidental thing or so some sad news regarding the gray whales, but hopefully we start to figure some of this stuff out as we move along, because they're very iconic animals to our coast. And so, yeah. So hopefully the gray whales find some sort of, I don't know, something to help their populations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of the environmental news this week. I know that you've had a busy weekend, as did I. I was actually taking care of my dad's dog. She was a very good girl, by the way. Very good girl. I got to tell you though, going back to the fact that it's been 2 years here, you know, I feel like at some point, right, as we hit years ahead, of course, here you are, you're down in Los Angeles, I'm up here. And so it's hard to celebrate the way that we should.
But
one of these years, for one of these anniversaries, we've got to just have some great vegan food.
Celebrate. And go whale watching.
Go whale watching or bird watching.
Both.
By the way,
look at the fucking animals.
This is gonna be shocking to you, but not only do I have a falcon tattoo, I also have whale tattoos. So I bet you that's shook. Right.
My mind has been blown.
and I have a mountain tattoo, so that covers the climbing. And yeah, hopefully, I know we talked about maybe having mom on the show this week, and now it's like I think we just hit the wrong hour for that to have her.
I want to have your mom on the show eventually.
We will.
Like we always, always record at like 11 p.m., 11:30 p.m., sometimes even later on like
Quarter
Tuesday
after
night.
Midnight right now. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's we always like I don't know. We just have a lot going on right now. But I'm actually, like, so for my other podcast, I'm going to do a few episodes, and then I want to take a month-long hiatus to, like, get more stuff prepped for that, to get, like, episodes, like, a backlog of episodes to do, you know, like, social media revamping, like, develop, like, more of a plan, launch a Patreon or shit like that, you know, like, get everything sort of sorted out so it's, like, not weighing on me quite as much. And no, then switch, and then once I return from the hiatus, switching to like a every other week schedule.
Right.
So hopefully I'll be able to record at an earlier hour and plan ahead more of these with you guys.
And we've actually talked about starting up some Patreon stuff as well for this podcast and being more interactive with people who are listening and stuff like that. But yeah, but so but no, I feel like if we ever did have like a anniversary get together. Like, it was so funny because I went for a walk down by the water with my mom today. And when she dropped me off in my apartment, she goes, yeah, because, you know, she always makes a lot of vegan food. And so she's like, yeah, I'm going to make some more vegan chili. And I'm like, yeah, great. I said, how about those enchiladas, mom? She's like, oh, God, I know. You wanted me to make more of the enchiladas. So, yeah. So if we ever have a anniversary celebration, mom will, you know, she'll get to celebrate, but her main job is going to be making enchiladas.
So mean to her. She's a personal chef.
Yes, she is. She's a personal chef of the conservationist conversation.
Oh, God. She has not made me any food yet. I mean, I get that, like, we live really far apart, but until, like, she makes me a bunch of food.
She's not our chef. Okay.
The show chef. And also, she'd have to get a cut of the Patreon if that becomes.
No, like, absolutely. But no, yeah, but hopefully she'll make, because enchiladas are so good, man. You don't even know. Like, I mean, when you taste them, you'll understand.
Okay.
But yeah, so the enchiladas, and then, yeah, she makes a vegan chili that's just great. So yeah, so we don't have mom on, but we will, we're giving a lot of credit to, you know, I wouldn't be here without her. And, you know, obviously. And
yeah.
So we're giving credit to mom who keeps me fed with her vegan food. And not that I can't cook, it's just that she cooks way better. And so, yeah. So 2 years of the conservationist conversationalist, myself being the, I guess, the originator, Aiden making
it
a
hell of a lot better. Yeah, the creator.
The creator, Aiden making it a hell of a lot better, and mom keeping me fed. but yeah, so speaking of your podcast, so yeah, you said you're going to take a hiatus. People can listen to it. It's called Dibs, Welcome to the Family. And mom, by the way, as you could imagine, listens to that religiously as well.
She does.
Yeah. And
which is great. I love her.
It's so funny. The other day, she's like, have you listened to Aiden, the latest episode? I'm like, oh, I haven't got around to it quite yet. And she's like, it's a very interesting episode. You need to listen to it.
It was intense. That episode, like, I recorded it and, like, I started editing it, and then I was like, okay, this will be a pretty easy episode to do. Like, I know what the story of the episode's gonna be. Like, I know, like, what I want to talk about. And then the amount of, like, and so because, like, some episodes, like, I sit down and I listen to, like, the interview, and I'm like, I don't really know what direction to take with this, you know? Like, and so those are the episodes I tend to, I start working on a lot earlier, because I know that I'm going to need to, like, get that story taken care of. But, with this episode, like, I sort of knew from the get-go, like, what I wanted to focus on, but then, like, I was sort of overwhelmed later on with the amount of research it took, and the amount of, like cross-checking, and, like reference, and the writing, and then, like, the editing, because I edited it pretty intensely. Like, I really, and then, like, I'm trying to figure out how to, like, do levels, so that, like, I don't have, like, parts of the podcast that are, like, really loud, and parts that are really, like, quiet. And, like, my the particular guest, like, she was great, but she also kept, like, leaning away and towards and away. Right. And
I know how that is.
A lot, so, like, yeah.
It can be tedious. Yeah, it really can. It's a tedious job, but yeah, you're doing great work there. So yeah, people can go listen to Dibs. Welcome.
Yeah,
to
it was good. Yeah, and then once you've listened to it, message me on, like, Twitter or something and tell me that I'm good and my time is good and I'm working hard.
And you can, of course, find our Twitter handles and all that in the description of this podcast. Yeah, so, and she's on Podcoin, iTunes, basically wherever you want to find podcasts for the most part,
yes.
The top ones.
If whatever you're using to listen to the conservation conversation list, you can listen to Dibs.
Right. And yeah, on top of that, you can listen to Lemonade Magazine podcast. That is my podcast. Well, it's the magazine's podcast. I shouldn't say it's just mine. But it's about music, and we've got interviews. We've got songs every week. This week, we've got Paul Abrahamian. He is part of Van Alden. He was actually a contestant on Big Brother twice. And he was a fun interview. Great guy and some unique stuff there. And I know that you always forget about this, so it's okay if you don't have one. But finally, the best thing I saw this week on the internet or on TV, I suppose. So this really isn't environmental or political, but it has some relevance to the fact that, so my grandmother was born in France, and I consider, like, my mom was born in, she was born in Germany, actually, but she was born, of course, to a French mother and a Canadian father. And so, you know, we love France. And the first French winner of the Indy 500 in, over 100 years, I think it's, yeah, over 100 years, close to that, won the Indy 500, but that's not what's exciting. What got brought up was the first ever, he's only the fourth French person to win it. And the first French driver to win the Indy 500, his name was Jules Gu, and he won it in 1913. And the best part about Jules Gu is that Jules Gu got to his first pit stop, and Jules said, "I need a pint of wine," although he said it in French, or at least with a French accent. And he said, "I need a pint of wine." Now imagine, they're driving 500 miles in a car at high speeds. Now, mind you, at that time, not quite as high speeds as they're driving now. And his pit crew said, "Well, we don't have any wine, Jules." And he said, "Well, go find some wine." So they went into the stands, where they found a group of Pittsburgh millionaires, randomly, who they said, "Hey, do you have some wine? Jules Gu needs some wine." And they said, "Of course we do. We have some from Laval. In France." And so they gave their wine to Jules. He drank 7 bottles of wine, I believe it was. Don't quote me on that, but it was a lot of bottles of wine while driving in the Indy 500, and he won, and he credited the win in the Indy 500 to the fact that he was drinking wine. And I found that to be the most French story I've ever heard in my life.
A little bit of a glorification of drinking and driving, but...
Well, but, you know, remember, on a closed track, you know, so he was only hurting other drivers and himself.
Doing a potentially deadly sport.
Yes.
Okay, well, Michael...
I'm not actually saying that people should drive drunk. I don't even drink.
Are you sure? Because it kind of seems like you're saying, like, if people drink wine and then, like, get on in a very fast-moving car, they can win races and be competent.
I mean, you know what? If everybody else knows it's happening, as long as it's not out where there's families driving and people who are unsuspecting, you know, yeah, go for it.
Anyways, my thing, I just sent you a Vine. I sent you a YouTube link because Vine's dead, but.
Yeah, Vine is RIP Vine.
Yeah, I miss it. Yeah. I never actually used it while I was still around, but I watched like Vines that were.
Watched a lot of Vines. Yeah. Cool guy syndrome is what you sent me. That's what you were asking about. I see. Okay. Gotcha. And should I play this?
Yeah, you can play it.
Okay, so I'm playing this, everybody, just so. I got diagnosed with cool guy syndrome yesterday. Oh gosh.
So now I take Adderall.
My friend sent me that Vine. I mentioned on my Discord. I mentioned like that I was had to go take Adderall, and they sent me that Vine. And it's an old Vine. Like it was uploaded to Facebook in like February 23rd, 2018. It's weird that that's like just over a year ago, and I already think it's old.
That's cool guy syndrome. That's great. I like that. I enjoy it.
Yeah. So I'm just going to play this again real quick.
Yeah. Here it is, everybody. If you didn't hear it on mine.
Wait, no. I just, I've been like cracking up at this Vine like constantly, and I'm going to be quoting it forever.
Got diagnosed with cool guy syndrome yesterday. So now I take Adderall.
That's just the funniest fucking shit in the world to me. And like, go Google or like go into YouTube and look up cool guy syndrome, because like this kid, like this fucking 11-year-old's face, like makes it especially.
Yeah, no, he sold it really well.
He's like, I got diagnosed with cool guy syndrome yesterday.
I miss Vine. I miss Vine too because of Crack Kid. Crack Kid is one of my favorites. I don't know if you ever watched Crack Kid, but
did not.
What was that?
Did not.
Oh,
did
you
not.
Look up Crack Kid. He's amazing.
Crack Kid. Okay.
Yeah, and also, but there is a great, there's a great duo right now. One's called Danielson, and they are hilarious. If you ever, if you've watched them, by the way, there was a Jeopardy contestant who wrote one of their videos or one of their like catchphrases for his answer on Jeopardy, which is "Baby, what is you doing?" And it was great. I love that answer on Jeopardy. But yeah, if you ever have a chance, look at "Baby, What Is You Doing?" It's another great video where they go into like Anthony Davis's house, and it's amazing. Yeah. So, anyways, but yeah, Cool Guy Syndrome. That was great. So that was your favorite thing you've seen on the internet this week. My favorite thing was suggesting that everybody should drive at high speeds under the influence of alcohol. So,
a great role model.
So, thank you once again, everybody, for 2 years of the Conservationist Conversationalist. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and Podcoin and Spotify and Google Play. You should probably like pick one of those, though, not do all of them. That'd be a little weird. but yeah, and if you would like to leave us a comment and a rating, that would be super cool of you. And we'll love you long time if you do that.
I'll love you anyways.
But. Yeah, well, I mean, I'll like them. I don't know if I'll love. No, I'm kidding. We love you.
I'll love them, and then you'll like them, and then they'll rate and review, and then they'll get all the love.
Right. Yeah. I'll
so
be a little
still getting some love as our listeners.
Yeah, you're a little easier to win over than I am. That's what it comes down to.
It depends. If you're a drunk guy in a bar, I'm like.
What about a drunk guy in a Indy car? Racing
wine? No.
Well, Aiden, thank you so much for being the for like I said, making the podcast better at 2 years. And yeah, we'll be back next week. Stay dope.